Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence we are grateful for having access to each week is our first guest. His name is Charles Sam Faddis. We're pleased to say that in addition to his service to our country in the uniform of the United States Army and without a uniform, in the clandestine services of the Central Intelligence Agency, he has been rendering extraordinary service here at Secure Freedom Radio and also on his website, andmagazine.com, a tremendous resource. He's an author. He's a former candidate for Congress. He has served in, as I say, myriad capacities that have informed his judgment about the things that we want to talk with him about today. Notably, his time spent with the Central Intelligence Agency in Pakistan in support of our operations across the border in Afghanistan. Sam Faddis, it's always good to have you with us, but especially at a moment when Afghanistan is very much top of mind.
Great to be here, Frank.
I want to talk with you first and foremost about Afghanistan, Sam, to get your take on what is the current state of play on the ground there and what is in the offing, as you see it, as a result of the rise, among other things, of the Haqqanis as the leading force, apparently, in Kabul.
Well, I think this is one of these situations where it would be very difficult to overstate how bad things are. You kind of grapple for words. This is a disaster of the first magnitude. It is not simply chaotic. It is not simply difficult. It has been mishandled grotesquely. We can discuss whether that's just incompetence or whether there's a significant amount of deliberate malfeasance. It is not getting better. Actions are not being taken by Washington to get a handle on this. So we have thousands of Americans still trapped in Afghanistan. We have a small army surrounded at a tiny airfield on the far side of the globe in what is what the president has been told explicitly is a militarily indefensible position, yet he has placed them there anyway. We now have the Haqqanis. I mean, for folks who don't follow this closely, when you hear the Haqqani network, you might as well just substitute the words Al-Qaeda, because they are joined at the hip with Al-Qaeda and have been for decades. These are the guys who's trained bin Laden, literally trained him when he was a baby Mujahideen. This is how bad it is. We don't know we can get our people out. We don't even know we can get our troops back. And the man in the White House is making no rational decisions to fix any of this. So we're trundling toward a cliff is where we're going.
When you talk about the Haqqani network as essentially Al-Qaeda, is there really a dime's worth of difference in terms of the ideology or the ideological fervor to which they attach themselves to what I call Sharia supremacism between the Taliban, between Al-Qaeda, between the Haqqanis, between, for that matter, the Islamic State?
No, there is not any difference ideologically. Look, there's not any difference functionally. These guys have, the administration wants now, as one of its many dodges, to sort of paint the idea that we're dealing with a kinder, gentler Taliban or some nonsense. This is a complete fiction. This is not true. There is no reality behind this. I don't know how to make it any clearer than that. That is not what is happening here. When you have these, the Haqqanis show up in Kabul and they are put in charge of the city, and as I understand it, are now beginning the preparation for what will follow the American withdrawal, which is a massacre. You might as well be talking about Al-Qaeda. You might as well be talking about ISIS. This is all of the same. We have not handed, the Taliban has not reformed. Nothing has changed. We are returning Afghanistan to the hands of Islamic terrorists who now are just better armed, emboldened, and more powerful than they were. And everything else is a lie.
Would it be fair to say that we have, by all of this, helped establish the Taliban as a dominant force within the global Islamic movement, which is Sharia supremacist in character and jihadist to the core? And if so, Sam, what does that portend, not just for Afghanistan and the people there, the massacre, and God knows what, but also for the rest of us, as one of your contributors and our colleagues in the Committee on the Present Danger of China and a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, Grant Newsom, has put it, what goes down in Afghanistan doesn't stay in Afghanistan.
Yeah, well, we will pay the price for this all over the globe. We will start seeing that impact immediately. We have not finished a war. We have not finished the fight. We have just ensured that the fight will be intensified and continued, and we will now see that that fight is no longer being fought on the ground in Afghanistan. It is now going to be fought all over the world. This Islamic jihadist movement is now already trumpeting the fact that, you know, they defeated the Soviet Union before us, and they have defeated us. Bin Laden just won. And, you know, he's a martyr to Islam, but there is absolutely no scenario here where the Taliban, where all that happens is the Taliban rules Afghanistan and just wants peaceful coexistence. That has never been what's going on, what's happening, and that's not what's happening now. So, you know, you can do all you want to lie about that and construct an alternate reality, but that doesn't change the fact that they live in this reality. We will be getting hit, and we and our allies all across the globe. We just poured jet fuel on a fire.
Given that you've spent time behind enemy lines in Pakistan, and I use that term advisedly, Sam Faddis, talk about the role the Pakistanis have played in all of this. And Laura Logan spoke about this with Tucker Carlson the other day, and I was really struck by it, the clarity with which she described the funding of the Pakistani military and intelligence services by the United States taxpayer as essentially funding the Taliban, helping enable the outcome that we are now facing.
It is absolutely true and indisputable that Pakistan, primarily via their intelligence service, the ISI, has funded the Haqqanis, funded the Taliban, supported them, played the other side of this year after year after year. And we have for many, many years been in this bizarro universe kind of relationship with Pakistan, where they play both sides of the fence and we sort of pretend like we can't see it for reasons that I have never quite fathomed. I have been on the ground in Pakistan, and where we were going to raid a safe house with the Pakistanis, for instance, a terrorist safe house, and you arrive at the terrorist safe house and to discover that before we could get there, somebody on the Pakistani side called them and warned them and ensured that the place would be cleaned out before we got there. So going through the motions of pretending to cooperate with us and then stabbing us in the back. And we should have crossed that bridge as a country a long time ago and made very clear to the Pakistanis that they got to pick a side and then they got to deal with the consequences. That's a geopolitical and strategic question as to why we did not. But it's undeniably true. And in fact, the information that I'm getting right now is that cooperation is ongoing with the Haqqanis. In fact, the other day we published in NAND magazine how the Haqqanis had just handed over to the Pakistanis a whole bunch of our MRAPs, our mine-resistant vehicles that they had captured. They're handing to Pakistani ISI and shipping into Pakistan vehicles they have captured from the American military.
And I gather it's not just MRAPs, as they're called. It's all kinds of kit that we left behind. This brings us to, when you talk about playing the other side, what the Pakistanis were doing in addition to playing with and for the Taliban in undermining the Afghan government, in attacking Americans at the same time that they were taking our money, they have also been joined at the hip, as you put it, with the Chinese Communist Party. Talk about, Sam, the role that the Chinese are likely to play both in Afghanistan and on the world stage in the wake of this, well, strategic defeat and gross humiliation of the United States.
Well, first, I mean, to sort of take it in reverse order, it is really hard to exaggerate the significance of this defeat. There may be a lot of people in the United States who are so tired of hearing about Afghanistan, want to stick their head in the sand. And there may be plenty of people on Joe Biden's side of the spectrum, whatever that is, who want to try to lie about this and downplay it. That does not change the reality. This is a defeat on a strategic level. And it's not just the leaving Afghanistan, it's the grotesque incompetence, the weakness, the malfeasance, just signals to everybody. It's blood in the water. Okay. These guys are ripe for the picking. The Chinese obviously have already taken Biden's measure long ago. They were already prepared to push very hard. They will redouble all those efforts inside Afghanistan. The way this is going to play out is people think that they think the Taliban cares about, you know, things like international recognition or, you know, the fact that somebody in the United Nations is going to say mean things about them or the West might sanction them. The Taliban doesn't care, first of all, because they don't really need a tremendous amount of money. You know, the 12th century is a cheap place to live, but also because they have already determined that they are going to give the Chinese access to the vast mineral deposits and natural resources of Afghanistan. And they are going to get plenty of financing and support from the communist Chinese. And that is going to give them all the cash they need to do anything. So this unholy alliance is already being formed, and the Taliban will effectively operate with plenty of cash, completely independent of any capacity on the part of the international community to sanction them or anything else you want to think about. So that's not going to happen. These guys are going to do what they want with their new Chinese partners, and they're going to start probably within a few days by taking down the internet, expelling the press, and then the real bloodletting on the level of, you know, Khmer Rouge killing field is going to start inside that country. That's going to be the first thing we're going to see. And we'll be lucky that it'll be the end of the month before that happens.
Yeah. But it certainly sounds as though they intend to have it be after the end of the month at the very latest. And they're insisting that we get out by then. The operations to extract people, our own or others, will, as a result, presumably have to be ended at that point. Raising the question as to what befalls people who left behind. And it seems as though there will be some Americans in that mix, not just those that are, we're told, deserving of our help in withdrawing from that country because they serve with us in various fashions. And that's another story for another day. Sam Faddis is how confident we can be about the people that we are extracting from Afghanistan at the moment. Sam, let me conclude this interview with a very important question. You've written at Ant Magazine that, quote, the traitor in the White House must go. He and his administration are working against us and for our enemies. I was struck by the fact that Colonel Richard Kemp, a very distinguished British Army officer, retired, who, among other things, commanded British forces in Afghanistan, has called on Mark Levin's show last night for not just the removal of from office of this president, presumably via impeachment, but he said, really, court-martial is in order for the commander-in-chief who has perpetrated this gross betrayal of our country and its military. Your thoughts on both the necessity of the removal from office of this president and how best that might be affected?
Look, I don't think there's any question but that this president needs to be removed from office. And I again, the magnitude of his malfeasance, for another time, we can debate, you know, to what extent this is just incompetence and dementia, to what extent this is he's been bought and paid for by foreign powers. This is threatening the national security of the United States. These are not missteps. This is catastrophe. He has to be removed. What's the best mechanism? Well, I think there are functionally two, right? The 25th Amendment and impeachment. What, of course, makes it so unpalatable is the idea that as soon as we remove him, we get Kamala Harris as president of the United States. I have heard rumors that Kamala theoretically is pulsing members of the cabinet in regard to the 25th Amendment. I don't know how true those are. I think at a minimum, we ought to see articles of impeachment introduced. I don't, and then we ought to pressure we know where Nancy Pelosi will go on that. She will stand with, you know, it doesn't matter. The morality of it doesn't matter to her. And let's find out if there are, how many members of the Democratic Party there are that, regardless of political considerations, still consider them first and foremost to be Americans and will stand up. But at a minimum, somebody needs to put articles of impeachment introduced. I understood they were being drafted. I don't think they have actually been introduced.
I gather that Marjorie Taylor Greene has introduced some, but not on these grounds. She had other reasons initially, but they're being, I think, crafted to address this Afghanistan thing. The idea of court-martial is, of course, not something that we've seen before or had rooted, but I think it does speak to the character of this military disaster and the need for accountability. So we might add that to the list of options to be considered. Sam Faddis, we have to leave it at that for the moment.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Colonel Richard Kemp is a highly decorated retired British Army officer who commanded his country's forces in Afghanistan. On Sunday, he shared with Fox News' Mark Levin the perspective of one of America's most steadfast allies concerning the Biden bug out from Afghanistan. Richard Kemp described it as, quote, the most disastrous foreign policy event for the United States of America since the Second World War. It is worse than Vietnam because the North Vietnamese were not trying to destroy the USA. The same cannot, of course, be said of the global Islamic movement, of which we have now made the Taliban a leading force, or Russia and China. The colonel's bottom line is that, quote, the threat to the West is worse now than it was on 9/11, unquote. For such betrayal, Colonel Kemp recommended that the commander-in-chief not be impeached, but court-martialed. Amen. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're very pleased to have with us one of our other regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio. His name, of course, is Gordon Chang, one of our duty experts on Asia, arguably among the most preeminent authorities on China in our nation today. He is the author of The Coming Collapse of China. You can find his writings, among other places, at Newsweek and the Gatestone Institute. He is a very, very valued contributor, among other places, to the Center for Security Policy, where he has just published an occasional paper about a topic we'll turn to here in a moment, COVID. But before we do that, I wanted to take stock with him about the Afghan disaster and what it might mean for emboldening China and intensifying the threat it poses to us. Gordon, first of all, welcome. It's so good to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Secondly, we've just finished a conversation with Sam Faddis on a similar topic, and I wanted to get your take on it. His view is that the Chinese are decidedly emboldened by the triumph of, the Taliban, with whom they're happy to work, and their friends who've made this possible, apparently with our money in part, the Pakistanis. Give us your reading on what it means for Central Asia and Afghanistan in particular, as far as the Chinese are concerned, and then broaden the lens for us as to how it might affect their attitude more generally.
Well, on the second question, we don't have to speculate because we can read Chinese media, and they're very clear. They have two themes. One of them is that no ally or friend of the United States can rely on Washington anymore. And they specifically said that when they invade Taiwan, the U.S. will bug out. The second theme is that the U.S., which could not deal with the Taliban insurgents, certainly can't deal with the mighty and grand China. With regard to China's relations with the Taliban, clearly they're trying to take advantage of it. They've had robust ties with the group, both before and after 9/11. And during the insurgency, we know that China supplied the Taliban with small arms that were used to kill American and NATO troops. And the story here, Frank, is not that the Chinese were complicit with the Taliban, but that we had a series of American presidents who knew this was going on and allowed it to continue, which means that we did not hold China accountable for killing Americans.
Killing Americans indirectly, or we'll talk about momentarily COVID directly, does seem to be something that we've not been holding them accountable for. Does that, Gordon, knowing them as you do, intensify the danger from that quarter as a result of them believing that we are now unmistakably in decline and unable to contend with the rise of China?
Well, it certainly emboldens China. There's no question about that. They look at all American presidents, Republicans, Democrats, liberals, and conservatives, and believe that they are feeble, and so therefore they can do what they want. And they've been very clear about that. As we've discussed before, Frank, when the two Chinese diplomats came to Anchorage in the middle of March, they actually said that the U.S. could no longer talk to China from a position of strength. And that theme has been repeated in official media, has been repeated by Chinese diplomats since then. We are in for a very difficult time. Now, I don't believe the United States is in decline. I think that we've got a president and a national security establishment that are incapable, incompetent. But nonetheless, we have seen series like incidents and periods like this before. The U.S. is resilient. It comes back because the American people understand that they need new leadership. You know, the Chinese always talk about the Saigon moment these days, referring to what happened in 1975. Official media points out they got these pictures juxtaposed of a Huey on the top of an apartment building near the Saigon embassy in 1975, plus a Chinook over Kabul in 2021. And they say history repeats. Well, yeah, history does repeat. And we now have our vice president who will be in Vietnam in a day or so, a Vietnam that is closer to the United States, which is far away from China in security terms. This is a very good story for the U.S. We do recover from grievous mistakes.
It will be interesting to see the upshot of this visit by Kamala Harris to Vietnam, Gordon, and whether it translates into evidence that the prospective president of the United States is, in fact, any more capable of conducting foreign affairs with various nations, including ones that we very much want to have on our side in the contentious part of the world you focus on, the Far East and Western Pacific. But before we leave this topic, Gordon, as China is insinuating itself into Afghanistan for extraction of minerals or Belt and Road purposes or to simply extend its influence more generally, what resistance do you anticipate they're likely to face there, if any, from India?
Well, India had very good relations with the Afghan government, and clearly India is there to frustrate China's purposes. In the early part of this year, it was Indian intelligence that provided the information that broke up a network of Haqqani fighters plus Beijing. We also know that China is really deeply concerned about what India is doing in Pakistan. They accused Indian intelligence of fueling the July 14th terror attack on a Chinese bus, which killed nine Chinese nationals. They accused the U.S. of that as well, of helping insurgents in Pakistan. So really, this could really broaden out to a very ugly fight, as China called India and the United States enemies and vowed to punish them. This was in a Global Times piece, which was published on Saturday, which really means that the conflict in Central Asia could broaden out to include the world's biggest powers, which means that this is not over yet. And this is not just confined to Afghanistan, Frank. This is a very dangerous situation when China actually says these things. We actually say that China is non-transparent. But when it comes to a number of things, as Jim Lilly, the great U.S. ambassador to Beijing, said, China always telegraphs its punches. China just telegraphed a punch.
They're also doing the same vis-a-vis Taiwan, are they not? There's obviously been an ongoing intensification of the threats to Taiwan, not just rhetorical, but military activity as well. Is it not the case, Gordon, that we could well see ourselves at the cusp of them acting on those threats, emboldened as they are?
Well, certainly. The propaganda against Taiwan after the fall of Kabul has really been tense. I mean, it's really been relentless. And, of course, there were the exercises of last Tuesday that China announced, both to the southeast and to the southwest of Taiwan. Of course, warnings. There was, at the beginning of this year, just every day, there were military exercises directed against Taiwan. Then they fell off for a couple of months, and it's interesting why that occurred. But the point is, it seems like they're now back on, which means that China is again pressing Taiwan, which means that the Biden administration has got to focus on defending Taiwan, because this is how the crisis in Afghanistan spreads.
Absolutely. And our Committee on the Present Danger, China, has recommended a number of steps that should be taken, we think, both to enhance our own tangible deterrence of Chinese aggression in the Western Pacific, but also to improve Taiwan's abilities to contend with and thereby also hopefully deter a Chinese attack. These are steps that are urgently needed, it seems to me, and I hope that, especially against the backdrop of what is going on now and Kamala Harris's visits to the Far East, they may be receiving more serious attention than they've gotten to date from the administration. Gordon, let me turn quickly to COVID. You've been reporting on this for some time. The Chinese, well, biological weapons attack against the United States. You've written a very important new occasional paper for the Center for Security Policy, I'm pleased to say, which is at our securefreedom.org website. Talk a little bit about what you're addressing in that paper, Gordon, and where things stand now vis-a-vis holding the Chinese accountable for not just an attack on the United States, but literally, as you say, this is the first time in world history that a single nation has attacked the entire planet simultaneously.
Yes, that paper discusses scientific papers that were issued 2016-2017, which showed that the United States has funding gain-of-function research in the Wuhan Institute of Virology. The reason why this issue is important is because in both May and July, Senator Rand Paul, a Republican from Kentucky, questioned Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, and specifically asked Fauci if NIH, National Institute of Health money, was used to fund such research at that location, and Fauci vigorously denied it. What these two papers show is that the NIH did fund such research, and those papers do reference Fauci's NIAID. This means that Fauci either committed perjury in both May and July of this year in his sworn testimony and answers, or the alternative is just as worse, and that is that he was negligent in administering NIH money. The reason why this is important is because, as I point out in the paper, the U.S. it was basically funding China's biological weapons research. And Fauci should have known that was going on as well, because China does have a civil military fusion doctrine where everything in civilian labs is pipelined directly to the military if it wants it. Plus, also, as I point out, this is based on the testimony of Dr. Li Mingyan, that all of China's biological labs are military. So given all of this, there has to be questions about Fauci's leadership and his role in leading our role in our fight against infectious diseases, specifically COVID-19.
And Gordon, I think we've talked about this before, but Colonel Dr. Lawrence Sellin has pointed out that it's not just what Fauci and his company, his team, have been doing in China that's worrying. It's what NIH and the CDC and the NIAI, they have all been doing to allow Chinese scientists in our own country to have access to our best laboratories and research institutions and universities, all of which seems to be feeding directly into this civil-military fusion, as the Chinese call it, and enabling this biological warfare capability in China to grow inexorably. And just a quick word in closing, Gordon, about why this has to be of paramount concern to us, not just because of what we've seen them do with this COVID-19, but what their doctrine and military plans call for us.
Yeah, they have a doctrine of unrestricted warfare. They say they don't, but they really do. And this, of course, comes from the title of that infamous book by two Chinese Air Force colonels in 1999. And the reason why this is particularly important is because Chinese military researchers have been very clear. They've been writing about, quote, specific ethnic genetic attacks. In other words, developing pathogens that will leave the Chinese immune and sicken and kill everybody else, which means that the next disease from China could be the civilization killer, leaving China as the world's only viable society. Now, I'm not saying that they have been successful in developing such bugs, but that's what they're trying to do. And just remember that Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, did spread COVID-19 deliberately beyond his borders. There's been no cost on China for that, which means that with impunity, he feels he can spread the next disease, which could be the one of specific ethnic genetic attacks.
Yes, and devastating effect on a country like ours that they've said they seek to depopulate. Gordon Chang, bracing stuff, as always. Thank you for your insights. Thank you for your expertise. Thank you for your generous time, which you give us each week. It's truly one of the high points of our week. Follow Gordon Chang at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter, as I do, for all the latest on his important insights and reports. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us again soon, if you would. Next up, we'll speak with Bill Walton. We'll take stock with him about what's going on with this infrastructure bill and much more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and pleased to be able to say welcome once again to Bill Walton. He is the star of the Bill Walton podcast program, a terrific TV resource that I commend to all of you. He is also a man we visit with each week to take advantage of his expertise in the world of finance, in which he succeeded handsomely in Wall Street, and then as a leader of the conservative movement, the Council for National Policy, of which I'm very proud to be a member. He is a utility infielder on what is facing this country at the moment, and we're always delighted to have a chance to visit with him. Bill, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you, Frank. As a utility infielder, I feel like I've got four or five batters at the plate. There's a lot to catch right now.
There is indeed. Let's start with the topic that I've been visiting with our previous guests, Sam Faddis and Gordon Chang, about. You have been watching closely what's happening inside China. And we've been talking about this mostly in connection with the rising power and aggressiveness of China, the degree to which it is likely to benefit from, certainly be emboldened by, the fiasco that the Biden administration has unleashed with its Afghan policy. But talk a little bit about what's happening that suggests some very, well, turbulent things are developing inside China on the economic and financial side of the ledger.
Well, Chairman Xi is cracking down on all the major companies in China, and he wants the whip hand, and he's cracked down on the technology companies, some consumer product companies, education companies. And the upshot is that just as recently as Friday, stocks of Chinese companies hit a fresh wave of selling, and they're down. You know, so Alibaba is down about 50% from its highs, and all of them are off 15, 20, 25%. So it's he's not only going after the companies and trying to get them to refocus on what he wants them to do, but he's scaring off investors. And even Goldman Sachs has warned off some of its investors in the investability of Chinese companies. Now, in the face of that, our old friend Larry Fink at BlackRock is telling investors that China's never been more attractive. You know, you and I talk about connecting the dots. These dots seem to be a million miles apart. It's very hard to figure out with precision what's going on right now.
He's actually said, as I understand it, in his, you know, missives to the investing universe, that he thinks a balanced portfolio involves a tripling of investment in China. And I just have to tell you, Bill, I've got a sneaking suspicion this is what would be good for Larry Fink, but not necessarily for clients. There have been instances in the past where people have, well, self-dealt, I guess you might say. It doesn't end well, generally, for the clients in the first instance, and often for the people making these kinds of recommendations. Do you think that's likely to happen with a guy who's got told now $10 trillion under management?
Yeah, I think he just went north of $10 trillion in the last month or two. You know, as we've talked about, BlackRock is the first firm that's allowed to launch a wholly owned subsidiary in China managing Chinese money. And there is a huge China consumer market, you know, $4 or $5 trillion, trillions of dollars of investment savings in China, and Larry's eyeing that, I'm sure. But in terms of investing in Chinese stocks, I'd advise people to stay far away at this point because they're finding new lows. But you know, as you see with lows, you can go down 50% and then go down another 50% if you're being attacked by your own government. And Xi seems to be signaling something that's very interesting. He's not only signaling that these companies have got to invest in things that he thinks are strategic militarily for China and in terms of its stabs of power, but he's also beginning to crack down on income inequality. And that's fascinating because there's a thing called the Gini Index, and it's a very complicated formula, but it basically tries to reduce the or to portray the differences in income equality in various countries. And it's used by the left to beat up people in the United States, saying, well, the rich are too rich, and we've got to equalize everything. Well, if you look at redistribute, that's what they do. You know, if you look at Gini coefficients, the most income inequality in the world right now, at least it was until recently, was South Africa. At 63, and then going down the list, just a couple. Brazil's at 53, Jamaica's at 45, and according to the calculations at the UN, the United States is 41. Now, they don't include transfer payments in that number, so I'd argue the Gini coefficient here is actually lower. And at the bottom of the categories, or the most equal, if you want equal distribution, you can move to the Ukraine, which is at 25. So if that's your ideal, we have a country for you. But here's my point. China, by recent calculations, and the numbers are opaque, you really know, came out at 70, which means it's higher than South Africa. And, you know, the in China, the top 1% of households own about a third of its wealth. The bottom 25% had only 1%. They've got 600 million people in China, but roughly 40% have monthly income under $140. And so you've got that on one side of the equation. On the other side of the equation, China's added about 145 new billionaires in the last 2 years. They've now got about 2,400 households that have wealth of at least 300 million and up. And so what's going on in part with this crackdown is Xia Ji wants to show that he's going to be directing state resources in the strategic industries. But I think he's also signaling that he wants to shrink we've got kind of a, what's it, the Edwardian age or something in China, where you got the rich people going around flouting their wealth, and you got roughly 40% of the country is making $140 $140 each month. So there's that, and then it's so, and they've actually, the rhetoric, the speeches, and there's a term for, and I'm looking around for, oh, I know, here's the phrase. It's called common prosperity, and they're going to more assertively promote social equality. And common prosperity is not very well defined. I think it's whatever he wants it to be. And
it does seem as though this may have a view to trying to make a little less uncomfortable the lot in life of those like Larry Fink, who are simultaneously, as we've talked with you often, Bill, promoting on the one hand environment, social justice, and governance agendas in our own country, and turning a blind eye to the terrible record on the environment, governance, and social justice of the Chinese Communist Party. So maybe by undertaking a redistribution of wealth that will improve their Gini scores and all the rest, there'll be a little less, hypocrisy for Xi's friend Larry Fink.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're in the business of trying to see the connections, and the connections are really interesting, because if Xi can go out there talking about social equality and reducing Gini coefficients, this, of course, is one of the things with ESG that BlackRock is pushing. And so Larry can say, gee, look how China's working to make things more equal. And it certainly gives him a good talking point, whether there's anything in reality or not. It's way too soon to tell.
For sure. Bill, let me turn to another public policy challenge that is top of mind at the moment, or should be, here in the United States. And that is the effort that is going to be mounted this week by Nancy Pelosi in the House of Representatives to secure passage of two priority legislative initiatives of the Biden administration. One involves the matter of infrastructure, or so we are told. The other, a sort of soft infrastructure initiative that is estimated to cost something on the order of $3.5 trillion all in. Let's start with the old-fashioned definition of infrastructure, roads, bridges, ports and the like, maybe even throw in the digital infrastructure element. I'd like to see at the very least some money spent on hardening our electric grid if we're going to be putting this kind of money out. I'm not sure that's actually addressed in this legislation, but there is an awful lot of other stuff that isn't actual, infrastructure that is being financed, even by the so-called infrastructure bill, let alone this this budget deal. So talk us through, Bill, what happens when you get this kind of money being thrown around so blithely?
Well, let's first put some color into what they consider infrastructure. It's $174 billion for electric vehicle subsidies. It's $590 billion for Green New Deal manufacturing and job training, including $35 billion for climate change research, $100 billion for broadband subsidies.
$35 billion?
$35 billion for climate change research. Now, let's dig into this slightly. If you want to understand why we can't get another side of the argument on climate change, is that all the money is going in on the left. And if you want a big job or a research grant and you're in the climate industry, you've got to reach a conclusion that the left wants you to reach. People who are toiling on the other side of the argument don't get any of this $35 billion. And so what they're doing is they're buying more, quote, research to support the conclusion they've already reached, which is they want to, they basically want to shut the economy down to this Green New Deal nirvana. But the other one, I think, is still in there. I'm not sure this came out. At one point, there was $30 billion for 75,000 more Internal Revenue Service agents.
Yeah,
that's in the infrastructure bill.
that's soft of a kind, that's for sure. But Bill, the point that I guess I really wanted to get at with you is, in addition to throwing money at pet projects of the hard left, what we're seeing here is just unimaginably vast sums of money that are being, as best I can tell, financed by simply printing more money. Am I right about that, first of all? And second of all, if so, what are the implications for not just the budget, but for our economy, for, you know, our debt, for interest rates, for inflation, for discretionary spending on things we need, like military spending?
Well, the implications are terrible. We're spending now, you can basically pay for this spending in three ways. One is raising taxes. Well, the richest 1% are already paying 92%, as much as 92% of all the other Americans in the United States. There's not a lot more juice in that turnip. The second way you can do it is borrow money. Our debt is now about 23 to 25 trillion, who's counting. It's about 120% of GDP. It's never been that high since World War II. It's projected to go to 50 trillion. And the third way you pay for it is you inflate. You just debase the value of your currency. And we've relied on our status as a world reserve currency. You know, basically, we're saying, look, everybody's got to take the dollars, so why not just print more of it? We're running a risk here of people eventually saying, look, we're going to find some cryptocurrency alternative, or God forbid, we're going to start thinking the Chinese currency is more attractive than the U.S. currency. I mean, we're pushing the envelope. We've never been. This is uncharted waters.
And again, if we do inflate by printing money, the payout of this extravagant expenditure, and we didn't really even get to the $3.5 trillion, which is soft infrastructure.
As you and I have talked, I think money needs to belong in the hands of people who know what to do with it, how to invest it productively. And you take this kind of money and have a government spend it on these things. There's no evidence that they can spend this money in any way that's terribly useful. I mean, look at all the failed deals back with energy and with Clinton, Solyndra. But with even with welfare payments and entitlement payments, which we've been doing for 100 years now, 90 years, we still don't know what we're doing. The fraud in the welfare system is calculated by some to be about 25% for almost $90 billion of fraud just in the last year. So we're sending out these checks from the government by some calculations. Steve Moore, I think, calculates that a family of four can get $100,000 a year from the various programs without working an hour. And so you got this money flowing to people, but it's also being divvied out by people in the various agencies who really don't know what they're doing.
And so, well, but it also is a model of state-run economics, is it not? I mean, essentially picking winners and losers and all of that at a grand level. And again, Bill, if we're talking about these kinds of investments, it's bad enough if they were just a one-off. But what's being put in train, to some extent, in the infrastructure bill, but also in the budget that is being laid out here, the $3.5 trillion budget, is a huge new entitlement commitment that would extend forever and cost untold sums of money, is it not?
It's worse than the New Deal it was in the 30s or the Great Society was in the 60s. The recklessness with which they're doing this. And also, I'd say on the Republican side, the fecklessness, because they're, you know, all those senators are in the Republican senators are in this mix, and they've gotten used to this insane world of trillion, $2 trillion, $3 trillion deficits, and they're just sitting there negotiating little pieces of these terrible bills. I mean, nobody'd step back to say, should we be doing this at all? Some brave senators got to say, look, we ought not be negotiating this bill. We ought to be killing this bill. Period.
And unfortunately, it's gotten this far. Both of these bills, the infrastructure bill and the Budget Reconciliation Act, either with the connivance of Republicans in the first instance or their inability to stop it being done through the budget reconciliation process. So, Bill, let me just tease this out one more step, because I think this is a place where particularly our audience is likely to be very concerned. If predictably the consequences of this kind of spending, this kind of inflation, is to create not only additional debt, but new pressure for interest rates to rise, to attract money to have people hold our debt, at some point, the amount of money that has to be expended by the federal government to pay the debt, simply to cover the costs of that borrowing, is going to essentially preclude discretionary spending on other things, including the readiness and capabilities, the modernization particularly, of our military.
What's our defense budget now? About $600 billion?
No, it's over $700 billion, I believe.
All right, $700 billion. But my point was, relative to our interest on the debt, I think interest on the debt is $400-500 billion range. And if we take our debt from $25 trillion to $50 trillion, about half of that new borrowing is going to come to pay interest on the debt. And that's based on CBO projections, which don't show high and rising inflation and rising interest rates. If interest rates go back to where they were when I started in the business world in the 70s, late 70s, prime is 20%. If it goes to something like that, and we're trying to finance all this spending with 5-7% borrowing, we can't pay a dime towards defense.
And that
now,
is
that
again
that won't happen. We're going to have some cataclysmic capital markets crisis that involves renegotiating all these arrangements.
Bill Walton, thank you so much for your time today and for your expertise in these matters. We appreciate the chance to visit with you.
I think I coined a new term for the Democrats and Republicans, Frank. It's the reckless and the feckless.
Come back to us again next week, if you would, Bill. It's good to talk with you. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.